Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by Fifth Third Bank and by the support of these donors.
At Fifth Third, we believe when diverse voices are heard and empowered, communities are made stronger, lives are made better, and the future holds greater promise for all. That's why we're proud to support Chicago Tonight Black Voices. Together, we can make a difference. Together, we can drive change.
Good evening and welcome to Chicago Tonight, Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman, and thanks for sharing part of your weekend with us. On the show tonight, a new report challenges the idea that Chicago has seen a decline in civic engagement. The head of Chicago's FBI office is retiring after 30 years, one-on-one with him to discuss top threats, his legacy, and more. Remembering Albert Woodfox, one of the so-called Angola Three, who spent 4 decades in solitary confinement. And the legendary Bud Billiken Parade is expanding its reach to a prominent downtown building. First off tonight, U.S. Census data says volunteering has declined in Chicago from 2009 to 2019. But a team of researchers at the University of Illinois Chicago say that's not the full picture. New research says previous data collecting doesn't include the wide range of community organizing in the city, oftentimes leaving out the work of Black, Latino, and working class people. Joining us now with more are Chris Polis, a postdoctoral research associate with the Institute for Research on Race and Public Policy at the University of Illinois Chicago, and one of the lead authors of this study, and Kennedy Bartley, senior legislative director with United Working Families. Thanks to the both of you for joining us. Chris Polis, let's start with you. So U.S. Census data showed declining rates of volunteering in Chicago from 26.7% in 2009, to 21.9% in 2019. But your data shows that that survey had some pretty big gaps in how data was collected, especially when documenting the work of Black, Latino, and working class people. What are those gaps?
Yeah, that's right. And to be clear, it's the data itself. One of the things that we looked at in the survey is how civic engagement is actually being measured. And that has a real consequence then on data that shows racial disparities and volunteering and voting and that kind of stuff. When we looked into the survey itself, a prominent survey by the U.S., which the U.S. Census conducts, we found that there were, especially in volunteering, there were biases against counting volunteer activities that are going to be disproportionately practiced by Black and Latinx working class people, such as like informal support networks or public meeting attendance. To give you a concrete, those conducting the survey, they have a sort of helpful hint sheet that says what's included is volunteering, what's not included. An example of informal support networks being excluded, they're instructed to say, you know, if somebody's, you know, asking what counts as volunteering, say building or repairing a house through Habitat for Humanity, it's going to be counted as volunteering. However, if I, you know, help my neighbor repair their house for an exchange for, I don't know, them watching my kids or something like that, that's not included as a form of volunteering. And that's just one specific example. Public meeting attendance is another example. Obviously, attending a public meeting as a community member to provide input or vote on something takes time. It takes somebody that, you know, figuring out their schedule, maybe changing up work or something like that. These types of activities aren't included. If you include those in a measurement of volunteering, a lot of the racial disparities shrink considerably or even reverse.
To that point, Chris, because I want to get Kennedy in here as well, you're talking about public meetings being a form of volunteering, and your research found that the racial gaps would diminish or reverse. The white to Black gap would shrink from 11.9 to 2.6 percentage points. The white Latino gap would reverse from 12.3 to negative 1.6 percentage points. Kennedy, I know that when we introduced you, you're with United Working Families, you've got a job change coming up, but what's your reaction to this data collection?
Yeah, I don't think that there is much surprise in the fact that, you know, a field that is like historically and overwhelmingly white and male, would define, you know, civic engagement in a way that is largely leaving out swaths of people who are taking, you know, control of their communities in the various ways that Chris has listed out and named out. During my time at United Working Families over the past 3 years, you know, every city council meeting, you know, folks are organizing people to do public comment and make demands of city council, right? I see, like, when working in the 20th ward, of predominantly Black and Latinx region in the city of Chicago, I'm seeing, like, all Black and Latinx organizers getting their neighbors to take charge of things happening in their communities. As recently as earlier this week, you know, we turned in nearly 4,000 signatures from folks on the Black and Latinx South Side saying that they want to see a referendum on the November 8th ballot, you know. Also, you know, doing this work on the shoulders of folks who turned out historic numbers in 2016 to vote Anita Alvarez out of office. Those were organizing efforts that were led by Black, Latinx, and predominantly, like, young folks. And so, you know, unfortunately, it's not surprising because of, like, you know, who was telling the story and who was at the helm. But I certainly... Go on, sorry.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, how does this limit the scope of what organizers can do if their work isn't being recognized by politicians and institutions and, you know, the big nonprofits and foundations?
Sure. I think, like, what it does is it creates a responsibility on the parts of organizers to make sure that the analysis that folks like myself and folks who I'm doing this work with and comrades who know that, like, how folks dictate our work does not actually, like, inform or impact our work. I think that it, like, leads to folks being disaffected and engaging civically. But I just think that it, like, creates a new onus on the part of organizers to, like, make sure that the analysis is, even if, like, data scientists who aren't, like, movement driven or, like, you know, come from a movement background are the ones defining our work as or as not civic engagement. Like, we know what we're doing, and, like, we are defining and redefining that for ourselves.
Chris Polis, back to you. How can civic life be better measured?
Yeah, I mean, I think, our approach in the report was asking the people that were doing the report. I mean, the question is, what, like, why do we want to measure it in the first place, I think is an important and interesting question. And in order to make that practically useful, I mean, what we did in the report was just ask people doing the work what were barriers and what facilitated civic engagement in the city of Chicago, and got a wide range of answers that I think were pretty useful that we lay out in the report in terms of how foundations can think about this stuff, and also actually how we can reframe civic engagement as something that government policy has a big hand in playing. For example, consistent budget cuts to schools and mental health clinics and all this kind of stuff, that does have an adverse effect on people's ability to get out, to volunteer their time and that kind of thing. So rethinking those kind of policies as well as, you know, funding these social services is absolutely crucial in encouraging civic engagement.
Okay, that's a good place to leave it. My thanks to Chris Polis and Kennedy Bartley for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Up next, Parrish Shucks and an exit interview with the head of Chicago's FBI office.
There is never a shortage of activity in the local FBI office, including massive investigations into things like gun trafficking and political corruption, most recent being the massive federal indictments of former House Speaker Mike Madigan and ComEd Associates. Now the head of Chicago's FBI office is retiring after 30 years of service. Special Agent in Charge Emerson Bowie Jr. is the first African-American agent in charge and has been running the Midwest's largest field office since 2019. And here to discuss his legacy and much more is retiring Special Agent in Charge Emerson Bowie Jr. Special Agent Bowie, welcome back to Chicago Tonight. Congratulations to you on your career. You took over here in your hometown in 2019. High-profile corruption cases, gun cases, and then COVID, civil unrest in 2020. What have been the biggest challenges running that office amid all of this?
Well, thank you, Paris, for inviting me back. It's a pleasure to be here. I think the challenges were the same challenges that most people experienced. Nobody anticipated the world being shut down by a pandemic. The pandemic itself presented challenges because people were concerned for their own personal safety and health, as well as their family's personal safety and health. And then it put everybody in a mess, which allowed people who were interested in committing crimes kind of a little more cover because, you know, it was harder to identify individuals. So that was difficult, not to mention because of social distancing and other concerns. A lot of innovative platforms had to be created to communicate and share information and things like that. So the work continue to be done.
Yeah, that mask must be tricky. And I'm just wondering, did you have Zoom meetings with sources or people you were investigating if you couldn't meet face-to-face?
Well, I mean, there were a lot of innovative techniques that took place. You know, nothing replaces face-to-face. You know, mainly what we had to do was create alternatives for communicating and sharing information with other law enforcement partners and intelligence partners to make sure that people were coordinated in their efforts in pursuing the various threats that were out there.
And of course, there were lots of threats as violence was on the rise over the last few years. And then you've got the big bombshell investigation into alleged corruption with ComEd and Mike Madigan. I know the FBI doesn't like to talk about specifics in cases, but what went into investigating a case like that?
Well, investigating public corruption cases, particularly high-profile corruption cases, a number of things transpire. It's very resource-intensive and things like that. So, again, here in the Chicago office, working with other federal, state, and local partners, we take pride in the efforts that we put forward to make sure that the citizens have the accountability they desire to make sure public officials and law enforcement officials are doing things the right way.
And it's not just the Madigan case in ComEd, lots of other public corruption cases in the last several years. Do you think that these cases will make a dent in future corruption and perhaps public officials thinking twice before they put their hand in the cookie jar?
Well, there is always, whenever you have a corruption case come to the forefront, the hope is that it will be a deterrent for others not to pursue that same type of conduct. The most important thing is that the citizens, if they are aware of anything that is going on that is inappropriate or that they believe to be inappropriate, that they report it right away. No one in law enforcement, no one that is taking their oath serious in politics wants anyone doing anything inappropriate. And in those situations where there are allegations, believe it or not, you have support across the board for those individuals to be pursued, to either validate the activity and take the appropriate action or invalidate the activity so that no one's reputation is harmed seriously by those allegations.
We mentioned the myriad gun cases and violence cases that the FBI has investigated, gun trafficking cases, gang cases. Explain to our viewers what the FBI brings to the fight against gun violence in Chicago.
Well, the FBI brings a number of things, particularly we bring a federal toolbox that incorporates a lot of different techniques and abilities to the table that state and local law enforcement may not have. The FBI is not bound by the city jurisdiction or the state jurisdiction because we're a transnational organization. And then, and also we have outreach into the international community as well. So that allows us to not just go after the immediate threat, which is the who's committing crimes in your particular city, but it allows us to go after the individual that may be supplying illicit guns or illicit drugs to the city through a chain in a number of other states or other countries. So we bring that capability. We're also the only organization in the world that has both intelligence and law enforcement authorities, which makes us unique as well because we're able to process information on two fronts, which makes us even more effective in how we do our business.
I know the FBI and DOJ has gone after cartels, even El Chapo Guzman. So you mentioned the roots of some of those things that cause gang violence. But this is your exit interview here. What do you believe, as you're going out, what do you believe the city needs more of to more effectively tackle this problem?
Cooperation. You know, it's a multifaceted problem. It has been ever since I was a young kid growing up in Chicago. There always needs to be alternatives, right? You can't arrest your way out of every situation. There has to be alternatives available for these young people to have opportunity and to grow as good citizens. You need to be able to pursue valuable employment or valid employment that's going to allow you to support yourself and your family. You also need opportunities to higher education. That always helps as well. And then in doing all that and pursuing those other alternatives, what it allows you to do is to see someplace other than Chicago and other than your own neighborhood and meet people who may or may not look like you that you can build networks and relationships with to also identify mentors, coaches, and other individuals that will support you in your endeavors to do better. So it's a multifaceted program that that needs to be implemented to give people alternatives. By the same token, law enforcement has a responsibility at every level. Prosecutors have responsibilities. The judiciary and the citizens have responsibilities to give people a honest day in court, a fair day in court. And if everything is working as it should, I think you'll continue to see a reduction.
And you certainly, your career in law enforcement has brought you all over the country. You came back in 2019 to your hometown of Chicago to lead this office. What do you want your legacy on this office to be as you leave now?
You know, so I never got into this job to necessarily have a legacy. And I guess my legacy will be what others who I have come in contact with, built relationships with and touched will determine it to be. But I would like to hope that if people were to discuss me in a positive way, that they would recognize first and foremost that I wanted to ensure that everyone had access to the FBI because it's the citizens' FBI. Everyone had access to me since I am the face of the Chicago division, and that in particularly underserved communities that we we're here to also assist you equally as other members of the community. So that's what I would like the legacy to be, one of cooperation, assistance, access, and fairness in executing our mission as determined by the threats that are presented to us. That's what I would like to see. It was a blessing to be able to come home and also be recognized as the first African-American to serve in this post. It's also a huge responsibility because I wanted to always make sure that I was presenting the best example for the people who I hope to see come after me, the third, the 16th, the 30th, or the 100th African-American or another person of color or minority that would have the opportunity to serve in this post because we have a multicultural city. And I think everyone should be able to see someone that represents them and their culture and their race in this post to give them inspiration to also do good things and pay forward and bring people forward.
All right. Quite a distinction to have being the first African-American in that post. You'll always have that. Congratulations to you. And thank you so much again, Special Agent in Charge Emerson Bowie, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
And we're back with more Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, right after this.
The 2022 Bud Billiken Parade marched across Chicago's South Side this weekend. It's one of the city's oldest parades, and this year, it's expanding its reach to downtown. The beloved Bud Billiken Parade is being celebrated in a film projected beneath the stars. Arts correspondent Angel Edo takes us to The Loop for more on the story.
The Chicago Defender newspaper is really what caused the launch of the Bud Billiken Parade. It was the newsboys
that would go out, Ray Sanderson was selling the newspaper, and Robert Abbott, great granduncle, came up with the idea to celebrate them, gave them bikes and instruments to go down the street and celebrate. And that's how we started the Bud Billiken Parade in 1929.
93 years later, the Bud Billiken Parade, or the Bud, is still marching down King Drive, celebrating one of Chicago's most influential African-American newspapers.
We are able to show that, you know, the community can come together, kids can come together in a very positive and peaceful way.
The parade marches from 39th to 55th on King Drive, bringing together Black Chicagoans through entertainment, food, and fun. But this year, the parade is also taking over a prominent downtown building in a projection film titled Billiken. It features dancers from the Bringing Out Talent Dance Company.
We did get some footage last summer, not even knowing if we was going to actually make it on the Art on the Mark. But just to have the footage already prepared and ready, so it's definitely dope and exciting to see it.
As one of many dance groups to perform regularly in the parade, Shekinah Stewart says watching themselves downtown is important.
Seeing themselves up there, it pushes them to want more and do more. So we're going to hope that when they see this and their families see it and they see that we're doing things with the kids that, you know, we normally don't do, it's going to get bigger.
But that exposure the film provides isn't just for community members that attend the parade regularly.
It's so powerful that Bud Billiken will be displayed on Art on the Mart at the Merchandise Mart because it gives people from out of town an opportunity to know more about this great event that's huge beyond measure. But also those in the community can feel proud about their tradition. We're talking about 93 years. So 93 years and many generations get a chance to see the Bud Billiken displayed in a way that's never been displayed before.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Angel Ito.
And if you missed this year's parade, don't worry. You can catch the Billiken at Art on the Mart every night at 9 and 9:30 until September 7th. And there are more details on our website. Albert Woodfox, who spent 42 years in solitary confinement, died last week. Woodfox was one of the so-called Angola Three, held in solitary confinement for decades after he and another prisoner were convicted of murdering a guard, a charge the men and their many supporters say was a sham. Woodfox became an activist, organizing protests within the prison and using the court system. He was released from prison in 2016. We spoke with Woodfox back in 2019 about his book, Solitary. We asked him about the importance he saw in educating himself while in prison.
By the time we were placed in CCR, you know, I had already joined Black Panther Party, and I had started down a road of redemption, you know, self-education. First step is to re-educate yourself. You know, because I was as much a victim as the institutional racism and the school system in Louisiana and America in the 60s. And in order to be able to lead or to inspire or to organize, I had, you know, Harmon and I and Robert had to, like, re-educate ourselves. And that re-education, It's sad to say that, you know, I was 20-something years old when I learned of the history of African Americans and Africa itself and the contribution that, you know, our people made to society and the development of society worldwide.
And along the way, you were able to teach a fellow prisoner to read.
Yeah.
What did that mean to you to be able to do that?
I consider that my greatest accomplishment, you know, because as he said one day, you know, I had opened the world to him, and yeah, it was a tremendous feeling. And I have, and all with all the things I've accomplished as a social activist in and out of prison, I still haven't matched that emotional feeling that when he said that to me. Yeah.
What is it that you want people to take away from your book, Solitary?
That it is possible to change. That it is possible to, you know, re-educate yourself, develop a sense of moral values, principles, sense of self-worth, dignity, pride, self-respect, and to contribute to the better of humanity and society as a whole.
Albert Woodfox died on August 4th. He was 75 years old. Woodfox wrote about his journey in a 2019 book called Solitary, Unbroken by Four Decades in Solitary Confinement, My Story of Transformation and Hope. And that's our show for this weekend. Be sure to check out our website, WTTW.com/news, for the very latest from WTTW News. And if you're watching us on Saturday night, know that you can also catch Black Voices and Latino Voices on Sundays beginning at 10 p.m. And join me and Paris Schutz next week at 7 on Chicago Tonight. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight Black Voices, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thanks for sharing part of your weekend with us. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm, and proud sponsor of programming that offers advice and strategies to enhance the physical and mental well-being of fellow legal practitioners in Illinois.